For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, so far, and it's been a little hiatus here since we last were in Exodus, let's recall where we left things off. We saw that God has gone into motion after being pretty silent for a long time. Nobody has seen him or heard from him, as far as we can tell, for like 600 years. And now, all of a sudden, the clock starts ticking again. He gets the Jews and moves them into that area of Goshen up there, which is in the Nile Delta, and it's a fertile place. And there they multiplied and became this great nation, a very sizable group. When they fell under oppression and slavery at the hands of the Egyptians, God then chose this baby. He has this lady put the baby into the water. The mother, the sister, of course, as we saw, were cooperating. It wasn't some thing that was done apart from human agency. It was done through human agency. Those work together. Now God's got his own man in Pharaoh's palace being raised as an Egyptian. Nobody knows he's a Hebrew. In fact, they all think he's royalty. It says that Pharaoh's daughter raised him as her own son. So everyone thinks this guy is like royalty, Pharaoh's daughter. And so it looks like we've got an excellent platform from which to launch this change that God has in mind. Moses obviously going to have to play his cards right to stay in here, get in line with the power brokers and be able to change policy. Maybe he's going to even wind up to be the Pharaoh, in which case he would have total say over everything. Even if he's not, because there's an older brother or something, he certainly is going to be in a highly influential place, and he's probably going to be able to get the Jews their freedom. Well, none of that turns out to be true. This is all kind of looks like it's headed that way, and yet the trajectory is in a completely different direction, as we'll see. Now, before we go into our text tonight, I want to talk about one or two other themes here. One of the main ones. You know, we're sitting in a situation where the Egyptians are polytheists. They have gods for everything. They, you know, gods that correspond to different natural forces, the Nile River, storms, agriculture, frogs, all kinds of things. And so to them, you know, and Pharaoh himself is considered God. So a major question comes up in this book, which is, who is Yahweh? Who is this? It's Yahweh that keeps coming up. These guys are showing up talking about him. Nobody knows the answer. Pharaoh doesn't know. He says, who is Yahweh? And I would obey his. Who is this guy anyway? I don't even know who you're talking about. He says, I don't know Yahweh, and I will not let Israel go. That's from chapter 5. So he's completely clueless on this. The Hebrews, they don't know either. The fact that God finds it necessary to repeatedly state formulas along these lines, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out under the burdens of the Egyptians. I'll also redeem you with great judgments. Then I'll take you for my people, and you will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out from the burdens of the Egyptians. And so God is, and this is repeated a couple dozen times, that then you'll understand who I am. And it's basically God is revealing who he is. Pharaoh doesn't know. The Hebrew people, they don't know. Moses doesn't know either. Nobody knows. And as we'll see tonight, has no idea who Yahweh is. and then he runs into him. So when you think about this, the people there in this story are a lot like a lot of people are today. They kind of know that there's a God, but they don't know too much about him. You know, a lot of the people I talk to are like, well, I believe there must be some sort of higher power or something, probably something out there greater. But then if you try to articulate anything about that, it kind of trails off and like, you know, we don't know anything about it. And so that's interesting because then that means this book could be important because the book of Exodus is answering this question. Who is Yahweh? A question that has never been answered. The book of Genesis doesn't really answer the question that well. And it's not really until Exodus that we really start to find out who Yahweh is. Let's read. Chapter 2, where we left off. This is the verse we left off. The baby has been picked up, taken to his mother to be nursed as a wet nurse. And then when the boy was older, his mother brought him back to Pharaoh's daughter, who adopted him as her own son. The princess named him Moses, for she explained, "I lifted him out of the water." Okay, many years later, when Moses had grown up, he went out to visit his own people, the Hebrews, and he saw how hard they were forced to work. During his visit, he saw an Egyptian beating one of his fellow Hebrews. Moses has become aware at some point that he's a Hebrew kid, that he is Jewish. And when it says many years later, no kidding, 40 years. He's 40 years old in this story. So quite a few years, and we're really taking our time here. He goes out, he sees this Egyptian beating one of the Hebrew slaves. After looking in all directions to make sure nobody's watching, Moses killed the Egyptian and hid his body in the sand. So Moses decides to help. It's like, here, let's kill this guy. I'll show him. I'll teach him. You know, it's like, good Lord. So that's your program for freeing the Jews. Let's grab this guy and kill him. Obviously, his action is foolish. This isn't going to do the Jews any good. It's also immoral. Even if this guy deserved to die, which is doubtful, that would fall to the state to do that, to the government, not to a vigilante. The fact that Moses looks everywhere to make sure nobody's watching shows that he knows that this is a wrong act, and the fact that he buries him in the sand to cover his actions as well. Of course, it's impulsive. He didn't really sit and think this through. This was an action in the moment, and it was totally ineffective. Like, this is going to make the Egyptians be like, oh, maybe we should let this nation go. We don't really need all these slaves anymore. Also, it was probably self-serving. It was probably that he went down and smacked the guy around a couple times and then realized that word would get back to the palace that he was siding with the Hebrews against the Egyptians. He probably had to shut the guy up. That's probably why he killed him. I mean, what other reason would there be? It just makes no sense. So we have it. Also, just, I don't know how important this is, but it's just interesting to notice that three of the greatest players in the biblical story were all murderers. Not sure what to make of that. I guess it just shows that God's willing to use some pretty crappy players. Let's keep reading. The next day when Moses went out to visit the people again, he saw two Hebrew men fighting. He comes up, "What are you guys beating up your friend?" Moses said to the one who had started the fight. The man replied, "Who appointed you to be our prince and judge? You're going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian yesterday?" At this, Moses was afraid, thinking, "Everyone knows what I did." And sure enough, Pharaoh heard what had happened and he tried to kill Moses. He sent the message out, "Get him." But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in the land of Midian. So now Moses isn't even in Egypt anymore. Midian is believed to be an area up by the Gulf of Aqaba, if you know where modern day Eilat is. It would be to the east and south of that. Bromley thinks it's not an area, but it's a league of tribes, and that the Midianites were nomadic. So this is probably a pretty vague general area there. Most people put it down here, but it's clear, you know, for instance, we can place in the story tonight, see Mount Sinai at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula there. He's over there. So, I mean, they're ranging all over this area. And that's a very sparse, desertous area. It would not support sedentary agriculture. You got to keep moving to find grasses and stuff like that. So that's where he goes. Well, when Moses arrived in Midian, he sat down beside a well. And the priest of Midian had seven daughters who came as usual to draw water and fill the water troughs for their father's flocks. But some other shepherds came and chased them away. So Moses jumped up. He rescued the girls from the shepherds. What did he beat them? Chased them off, apparently. And he drew water then for their flocks. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked, "Why are you back so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds," they answered. "And then he drew water for us and for our flocks." "Well, where is he then?" the father said. "Why did you leave him out there? Invite him to come and eat with us." So they go back and invite him. And it says Moses accepted the invitation and he settled there with him. This Reuel, also known as... Let's get another one. Jethro. Yeah. That comes up later. He's called Jethro, too. In time, Reuel gave Moses his daughter Zipporah to be his wife. Later, she gave birth to a son. Moses named him Gershom, for he explained, "I have been a foreigner in a foreign land." That's from a stem, meaning a wanderer, a foreigner. In verse 23, we read, "Years pass." Oh, yeah. 40 more years pass, according to chapter 7, verse 7. By this time, when this story occurs, Moses is 80 years old. He is an old, old dude, way older than in the movie. And I think there's something to ponder there, too, you know, to really think about how long that really is. You know, most of you are nowhere near 40 yet. So it would be like your whole life times like four or five or three or whatever to get to 80. That's how long this has been gotten ever since that baby story with the basket up until this story tonight, 80 years. Why? And, you know, why is God taking his time like this? Why does it take so long? We ask these questions a lot, still of God today. He doesn't move on the same timetable we do, that's for sure. You know, an eternal God is not in a big hurry. He's been around for quite a while, forever. And so from his perspective, 80 years is probably a small change, but there's probably needed preparation that is going into his man here. He's getting Moses ready. And that takes time. And so we'll find that we have to undergo similar preparation ourselves. And this accounts for why God can really take his time letting things advance. And we often are impatient and feel they should be moving a lot faster than they do. So years passed and the kings of Egypt died. That's one reason. Although if you study the chronology of this period, the guy that was probably the guy that drove him out had been dead for quite a while before this incident happened. Anyway, the Israelites continued to groan under their burden of slavery. They cried out for help and their cry rose up to God. God heard their groaning and he remembered his covenant of promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then he looked down on the people of Israel and he knew it was time to act. Chapter 3. One day Moses was tending the flocks of his father-in-law, she's Jethro now, the priest of Midian. He led a flock far into the wilderness and he came to Sinai, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. Moses stared in amazement. Though the bush was engulfed in flames, it didn't burn up. So there's just this, maybe it's just this energy You know, that they would have to describe that as fire. I don't know if it was literally fire or what, but definitely a light. The angel of the Lord, it's God himself. This term, the angel of the Lord, it's not an angel of the Lord, it's the angel of the Lord. And the word angel just means a messenger or a sent one. And so as Kaiser points out in Hard Sayings of the Old Testament, he lists off a whole string of passages where it says that the angel of the Lord is God. It's not God the Father, it's God the Son. It's Jesus, actually, in his pre-incarnated state. He's the one that always comes out and deals with people. The Father, no one has seen or can see. And even later in this book, Moses says, I want to see you. And he's like, you couldn't live if you saw me. We'd kill you. So it's not the Father, it's Jesus. The second person of the Trinity. Of course, later in this passage, he says, I am God. The angel of the Lord says that. So there's no question about this. It is God speaking here. Well, Moses says, this is amazing. Why isn't that bush burning up? I got to go see it. So probably he left his flock and goes up this hill a little ways to look at this bright burning bush. When the Lord saw Moses coming to take a closer look, he called to him from the middle of the bush. Moses, Moses, here I am. Moses replied, he knows my name. Don't come any closer, the Lord warned. Take off your sandals, for you're standing on holy ground. Wow. So, God shows up and takes this form of a burning bush. It's his voice calling out to Moses. And yet, he says, stop right there. And so, this is something we're picking up already, information about Yahweh. He's not somebody that where you can just blunder into his presence, you know, and willy-nilly just walk up and, you know, high five and so forth with God. There's a little problem here, which is that God's saying, hold it right there. You're different than me, okay? I'm completely distinct and morally, qualitatively different than you are. You cannot come that close to me. And this notion of being distinct, of being separate, is the word that's translated holiness. It's the holiness of God. He looks Moses up, but won't let him come too close. This message about how God is different than us is something we have to comprehend and get through our heads. And it's exemplified throughout this book. A lot of the things they set up in like the tabernacle and the way that they would worship God and stuff, all talks about the separation between man and God. That every human is a fallen human, guilty of sin, and that is offensive to God. That makes us incompatible with God. If something has to be done, we can't just walk in and have fellowship with God. Something has to be done about this debt, this shortcoming that we have in our character. And so this is the beginning of the story of Jesus. This is the story that ends at the cross of Jesus Christ. And all of these things are set up to explain that a sacrifice has to be offered. An innocent has to die so that the guilty can have access to God. And that's, you see it already showing up right here. Well, he says, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. When Moses heard this, he covered his face because he was afraid to look at God. So he knew these, you know, the Jewish people, they had their stories that had come down about their ancestors and these names, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. These are ancestors. We read about them in the first book of the Bible, in Genesis. And it's been 600 years since the last of those guys lived. And now he's like, I'm back. Now that all of that time, what was happening was the Jewish people were percolating and expanding. And there was that necessary kind of an incubation period there. And now he's coming back and reinserting himself. We notice something else about Yahweh right away. The Lord told him, I've certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers. Yeah, I'm aware of their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and lead them out of Egypt into their own fertile and spacious land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey, the land where the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites now live. Look, the cry of the people of Israel has reached me, and I've seen how harshly the Egyptians abused them. Now go, for I'm sending you to Pharaoh. You must lead my people Israel out of Egypt. And we read that Moses protested to God. I can see this. You know, it's like you're there and you're like, okay. And now go, you're going to go to Egypt and you're going to lead my people out. And be like, wait a minute. Whoa. You know, you can feel Moses here a little bit. What? What did you say? He's like, who am I to appear before Pharaoh? Who am I to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt? Good question. He's a wanted man down there. He just fled from that very court. And now he's going to wade in there and say, I'm taking these, you know, umpteen thousand people out of here and we're leaving them. God answered, I'll be with you. And it's really all you need to know for anything like this. You know, when God calls someone to serve him, there is this feeling that we can identify with Moses, where I'm just like, I can't believe that you're even suggesting that. I got nothing to say. I got no gifting. I'm nobody. And you're calling me to do what? And he says, I'm with you. That's the point. Yeah, you are nothing. Glad you noticed that. But I'm going to be with you. And that is a totally different story. He says, this is your sign that I'm the one who has sent you. When you brought the people out of Egypt, you'll worship God at this very mountain. You're going to bring these people down here. Well, Moses protested a second time. Hey, if I go to Israel, people of Israel, I tell them the God of your ancestors has sent me to you. They're going to ask, well, what's his name? And then what do I say? So this is kind of, I guess, a way of saying, so God, what is your name? And it leads to one of the most intriguing, you know, passages in the Bible. God replied to Moses, I am who I am. So say to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. This word right here. It's the Hebrew verb to be. And in this form, this is spelled in Hebrew with consonants, YHWH. Because they don't put the vowels in when they spell words. But it's Yahweh. That's his name. It's him. And here, he's explaining his name, which means to be. I am in the first person. And it has something to do with this statement. I am who I am. So what is God saying here? What does his name mean? You could look at it several ways, several possibilities. One might be that this has to do with God's immutability, which means that God's unchanging character. So there is no, I was this way and I will be that way. It's just like I am. I am what I am. I am who I am. And it's a statement of the unchangeableness of God. Or is it God's infinitude? That he's expressing the eternality of his existence, both to the past and the future, that here he kind of exists outside of time in a perpetual present. That's a possibility right there. Or is it that in any, as we go out to think about reality, you got to start your thinking somewhere. Where does your thinking start when you start to appraise the universe and everything that exists? You start with God. He's saying, I'm the beginning point. This is kind of the idea of being the ground of all being. I am. That's your starting point right there. And everything else comes from that. Or is it the God who reveals himself. And under this one, he's saying, I am who I am. I'm not who they want me to be. I'm not who you want me to be. I am who I am. And you need to adjust to that truth. Yeah, that could be too. Well, it's probably some kind of mixture of all of these, isn't it? We've got total transcendence being expressed here. And it's a very powerful thing, I think, to ponder. That's an awesome concept. That's I am. Well, God also said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. So here we go with the names again. And what we're seeing is that Yahweh reveals himself in history. That is really at variance with the gods of the ancients, not just in Egypt, but everywhere in the ancient world. The gods are gods of nature. I'd like to read you a few comments from one of my favorite monographs by G. Ernest Wright, who's a Harvard professor of history, who wrote this monograph called The Old Testament Against Its Environment. And it's one of the most insightful essays. It's in the e-books if you want to read it. One of the points he makes is this one about how strange it is. And this guy is not any kind of a Bible believer per se. I mean, he believes, you know, he accepts the JEDP theory and all that stuff. He doesn't think these were written by Moses. it's even more interesting in that, in a sense, coming from someone who's a skeptic than it would be coming from a believer. But his observations in this you know, 80-page essay, or it was actually a series of speeches, I think it's just incredible, very accurate. He says the issue in the Old Testament is not the careful weighing of various merits of the gods. It is rather, who is God? Decide on the evidence and act accordingly. What is the evidence? It's the evidence of history. What God has the power to do what he wills and to fulfill what he promises. The God who can move into history and make his will happen there. That's Yahweh. Virtually the only comparative religion which the Old Testament possesses is of this type. Baal, for instance, could do nothing. He talks about Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Who's going to, you know, give us, make something happen historically here? Let's not speculate about the God of the river or what makes thunderstorms or whatever. This, you know, do something that's supernatural. Do something that's powerful. They can't do anything, and that's the way the gods of the peoples are characterized. The contemporary polytheism, having analyzed the problem of life over against nature, had little sense of or concern with the significance of history. Nature, with its changing seasons, was cyclical. This is very true if you analyze ancient religious literature. It's mythopoeic literature. It takes place in a you know, never land. Or you know, it's like Jack and the Beanstalk. It's in this timeless, you know, distant, far away, and long ago type of thing. That is uprooted from history. When we open our Old Testament, we read something completely different. When we read about the cities there, when we read about the place names, like Mount Sinai, like the land of Midian, like Pithom and Pi Ramses, these places actually exist. And so this is actually a time period and a place that is real. And that Old Testament revelation of Yahweh is unique in this regard. There's nothing else like it in ancient literature. Yahweh was the God of history, the living God, unaffected by the cycles of nature, who had set himself to accomplish a definite purpose in time. He's pursuing this plan. He's got this. He's on a mission. He's accomplishing something in history. Consequently, The religious literature of Israel is primarily concerned with the history of God's acts in and through his chosen people. So after this event, as we go on later in the Old Testament, it's not only that I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's also, I am the God who brought you up out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. I'm the God that did this. I'm the God that did that. And this is how we know God. Still true all the way through to the great historic intrusion into human history in Jesus Christ, which was like the ultimate historical act on God's part, the death and the resurrection of Christ, which is the basis, as Paul points out, for everything we believe. The story of the past was the guide to the present and the key to the future. We can still say that today. We have to read the story of what God has done in history. That tells us where we're at. That tells us what matters. That tells us who he is. And that tells us where things are going to go in the future too. Old Testament revelation, furthermore, he says, was not primarily in dreams or omens. They had dreams. Very little, you know, when you look at other religion, ancient religion, you go to the shaman to get a reading on whether I should take this trip this week or, you know, what should I do about my sick daughter, get a healing. You go to get an incantation, magical protection, stuff like that. And he's like, all of this is just gone from on the Old Testament. Nothing on any of that. And so the Old Testament is extraordinary. It's absolutely one of a kind in this regard. The knowledge of God was something far greater than a specific answer to a specific question in an oracle. Like, should we go out to battle, you know, this summer, or should we wait? History was important and was carefully examined because the true knowledge of God was there to be found. So, Yahweh, we're finding out who Yahweh is. He's the God who reveals himself through history of his redemptive acts. He says, this is my eternal name, Yahweh, that is to be remembered for all generations. Now, he says, go and call together all the elders of Israel. Tell them the Lord God of your ancestors, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me. He told me, I've been watching closely. I see how the Egyptians treat you. And I promise to rescue you from your oppression in Egypt. I will lead you to a land flowing with milk and honey, the land of the Canaanites, says I'm going to recess all that again. The elders of Israel will accept your message. Then you and the elders must go to the king of Egypt and tell him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So please let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. It's not clear why the request was for a 3-day journey when the intent is clearly that you go to a new land. I think it could be an interesting case. You know, one of the problems you can run into is if you try to come up with hypothetical situations where God is concerned, it doesn't work out because there are no hypotheticals with God. God knows what's going to happen absolutely and with certainty. He knows without any doubt that Pharaoh is going to answer no to this request. And it may be that just a simple request for a 3-day break from work is like such a reasonable request that if his answer to that is no, then obviously his answer to the larger question where we want to be freed forever would be no as well. So it could serve as kind of a demonstration of the obstinacy of Pharaoh. Well, he says, I know the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand forces him. So I'll raise my hand and I will strike the Egyptians, performing all kinds of miracles among them. Then at last he'll let you go. And I will cause the Egyptians to look favorably on you. They will give you gifts. And when you go, so you will not leave empty-handed. Every Israelite woman will ask for articles of silver and gold and fine clothing from her Egyptian neighbors and foreign women in their houses. And you'll dress your sons and daughters with these. Thus, you will plunder the Egyptians. So they're not only going to let you go, they're going to fit you out with everything you need, including money. Well, Moses protested again, a third time.
No, man, it's okay. What if they don't believe me? What if they don't listen to me? What if they say the Lord never appeared to you? And so the Lord says, what's that in your hand? He's like, a shepherd's staff. Throw it down on the ground, the Lord told him. And so Moses threw down the staff, and it turns into a snake. Moses jumps back. Oh! And then the Lord told him, reach out and grab its tail. So Moses reached out, he grabbed it, and it turns back into a staff instantly. It's a miracle. Perform this sign, said the Lord told him, and then they will believe that the Lord, the God of our ancestors, the God of Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, and Jacob, really has appeared to you. And then he says, the Lord said to Moses, now put your hand inside your cloak. He put his hand in, and then when he took it out again, his hand was white as snow with a severe skin disease. Leprosy is what the text says, leprosy. Could have, they called leprosy, they referred to quite a few conditions as being leprosy, but that's what they believed it was. Leprosy, scared people to death. Now put your hand back into your cloak, the Lord said. So he puts it back in and came out, and it's normal. So he says, there's another little sign. He says, if they don't believe and they're not convinced by the first sign, then they can be convinced maybe by the second sign. And if they don't believe you or listen to you, even after these two signs, then take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. And when you do, the water from the Nile will turn to blood on the ground. So he gives him three different miracles he can do to convince people that this is really God. And I guess this makes a certain amount of sense. Why would anybody believe some crazy that comes walking in from the desert, some old man saying, God, just talk to me, you know? You'd have to back that up with something. And he gives him three miracles that he can perform. And it all starts with this staff, this walking stick that he's got. But Moses pleaded with the Lord, oh Lord, I'm not very good with words. I never have been, and I'm not even now, even though you've been talking to me. I get tongue-tied, my words get tangled. I'm not well suited to this mission. And the Lord asked Moses, who makes a person's mouth? Who decides whether people speak or don't? Who, whether they hear, whether they see or don't? Is it not I, the Lord? And so this question that God comes back with, you know, it seems like Moses is doubting himself here. Oh, I'm not a good speaker. But you can see in God's reply that Moses is really doubting God, because God's saying, what are you saying, that I'm not able to get you to speak when I'm the one that created the mouth in the first place? You wouldn't even have a mouth if it wasn't for me. So that's an interesting point to ponder, because I think that in some ways we can kind of sense that Moses, maybe initially it was legitimate for him to say, now wait, I don't understand this. I need a little bit more information here. But now it's like he's got information, he's got the signs, but he's continuing to whine and carry on and say, I can't speak very well, which we will be this way too. It's like, I can't do this, I don't know enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not attractive enough, I'm not this, I'm not that, and it seems like I'm just doubting myself. But we're really doubting God, we're really doubting that God can empower us. Now go, he says, and I'll be with you as you speak, and I will instruct you on what to say. Well, Moses, again, please, Lord, please send anyone else. If it's the fourth or fifth time now, he's just like, I don't want to do this. And we read that the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. God is getting tired of this. This guy is basically giving God the finger. He's basically saying, I'm not, I don't want to do it. And so he's refusing the call. And the anger of the Lord burned. So this is not a good situation to be in. But very interesting where God goes from here.
He says, all right, what about your brother Aaron, a Levite? I know he speaks well. Isn't that odd? Here it's like the anger of the Lord burned and you're expecting, lightning out from the bush. Now let's see you say that again. You know, or whatever. And really, that would have been, he had a reason to do something like that. But he does. Instead, he does this. What about Brother Aaron? I know he can speak well. And so it's like, it's really funny, I think. It's kind of a funny thing where God's kind of accommodating and being way more merciful than you would expect, I would say, in this situation. And then, I'm switching, that's NLT or NASB. He says, and look, he's on his way to meet you now. He's going to be delighted to see you. Oh, well. So God saw all of this coming. All of these responses by Moses, he knew every one of those was coming. None of that surprised him. It still angered him to hear him sitting there, refusing. But we read later in the chapter 4 there in 27 that the Lord had said to Aaron, that's Moses' brother, go meet Moses in the wilderness. So he went out and he met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. So God had fully anticipated Moses' reaction here and had already called Aaron out. And as Moses comes down from the mountain, here comes Aaron walking up. Well, well, well. Surprise, surprise. And so God goes on, talk to him, to Aaron, and put the words in his mouth. I'll be with both of you as you speak. And I'll instruct both of you what to do. Aaron will be your spokesman to the people. He'll be your mouthpiece. And then you will stand in the place of God for him. So it's like, I give it to you, you give it to him. And then he tells it to Pharaoh, or whoever, to the elders. And he says, take your shepherd's staff with you and use it to perform the miraculous signs that I've shown you. So Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and he says, how about let me go back to my relatives in Egypt? He said, I don't even know if they're still alive. And Jethro says, go in peace. We read then that before Moses left Midian, the Lord comes back again and says to him, return to Egypt, for all those who wanted to kill you have died. So we're ready, go. And Moses took his wife and sons, put them on a donkey, and he headed back to the land of Egypt. In his hand, he carried the staff of God. The stick plays quite a role in the rest of this story. It's a point of contact. It's a reminder that the stick is like nothing but a stick. And this is the point. The essay I like on this staff of God the most is found in the book by Francis Schaeffer called No Little People. The first chapter is the essay, No Little People, No Little Places. And it's about this stick. The whole discussion is kind of about this stick and the relevance this has to us as those who would serve the Lord. He says, one thing that has encouraged me as I've wrestled with my own sense of inadequacy is the way God used Moses' rod, a stick of wood. Exodus 4:20 tells us the secret to all that followed. The rod of Moses had become the rod of God. That's this verse right here. In his hand he carried the staff of God, the rod of God. And of course he goes through all the different things, and then we'll see in the 10 plagues, he always says, take out your staff and go up there, touch the Nile River. Take out your staff and hold it out and hail will fall. All these different things. It's always the rod. It's always the staff that makes it happen. And so this kind of puts a slight distance between Moses being the one, so that there won't be confusion that this is Moses doing it and God works through the stick. Finally, culminating out in when they're trapped up against the Red Sea with the entire Egyptian army. What good is it to lift up a stick, a rod, when one's caught in a cul-de-sac between the mountains and a great body of water with the mightiest army in the world at his heels? Much good if the rod is the rod of God. The same rod later used, Moses uses to strike the stone. It comes up later in the story, make the water come out. This is the same rod that grows buds and bears fruit when Aaron plants it in front of the altar to designate who's in authority. And so it's really a centerpiece in this story. And yet it's an inanimate piece of wood. It's a nothing. And so Schaefer kind of summarizes his point by saying that the scripture emphasizes that much can come from little if the little is truly consecrated to God. Consecrated means like given over, dedicated, like you, I'm yours, God. And so just like God, if God can use a stick, then what could he do with a person? Same thing. And it's kind of like what we're to see here is, as he says, there are no little people, and there are no big people in the true spiritual sense, but only consecrated or unconsecrated people. That's the question. So it's kind of similar to that story of the boy with the two loaves or two fish and five loaves and two fish, right? It's not that these were magic fish and loaves or anything. It's that he put it in the hands of Jesus. That's what made it able to feed 5,000 people. We have a very similar concept right here. The rod of Moses. And God just picks something that just happens to be there. And he says, and of course he's lining up too for a shot. With the fact that the rod turns into a snake, he's lining up for a shot at one of the key Egyptian deities. Okay, so let's go back to our original question. Who is Yahweh, anyway? Who is this Yahweh? As Pharaoh puts it, I don't know anyone like that. Well, we've learned a few things about him already. We've learned that he's holy, he's different than us. And that morally, he's on such a different plane that something has to be done. Before we can draw close to him, we don't qualify to draw close to him the way we are. Something's going to have to make our way into intimacy with Yahweh. Something has to be done about all of that wrongdoing in our lives. That has to be swept away somehow. We've seen that he is the eternal and unchanging I am. That no matter how far back we go, God, already there. And he was just as old then as he is now. Whoa. Wait a minute. Yeah. People say, well, I don't think God could be eternal because where did he come from? Something's eternal. Think about it. Something's got either that or just everything came out of nothing for no reason. You believe that? If you believe that, you can believe anything. I believe something has to have been here all the whole, you know, forever. And so that there is cause and effect, such a thing as cause and effect. And I don't think it's the physical universe, because we can put a limit on the age of this universe, about 13.7 billion years. So something else must have been there before that. I am. That's what. I was there. I'm still there. He is who he is. He's not who we want him to be. Something that as postmodern people, we got to come to grips with. We don't get to decide who God is. It's not up to us in any way, shape, or form. As he put it, I am who I am. And, you know, you need to adjust your perspective to reality, which is I am. That's reality. We saw that he's personal and deals mercifully with people. He's personal. He has feelings. Yes, he could feel anger when Moses is standing right there just saying, no, 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 no. And it made him angry. He had feelings. And yet, there's that, you know, pretty merciful response, you know, where he's like, all right. What about Aaron? We'll go with the Aaron plan, which I've already put in motion because I knew this was coming. And so he's a personal being. We see that he's pursuing a plan of rescue. In this story, he's rescuing the Jewish people from slavery from Egypt. And yet, this is just the beginning of a larger rescue plan to rescue the entire human race. It's all of us who are in slavery. This whole thing is symbolic. As Jesus said, anyone who sins is the slave of sin. And he says, I came that you could have freedom and that you could know the truth and the truth will set you free. So it's redeeming from slavery, winning us out of slavery, getting us our freedom, which God was starting this plan back here and had really started it hundreds of years earlier already and continues to work it all the way up until the coming of Christ and really all the way up to our own day where he's still rescuing people on every side. Anyone who wants it can be rescued. John 3:16, Jesus said, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, so that whosoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life." Whosoever. Do you want to live forever? Do you want to be freed? Rescued by God? It's right there, offered by Jesus Christ. And this story that we're reading is the beginning of this process that ended and culminated in the coming of Christ. Finally, he calls us to join in with him in advancing that plan. This, just as he was doing with Moses here and Aaron, he's calling them. He's saying, okay, I got a job for you. Got something for you to do. And of course, so then we have the whole kind of humorous interchange there. But in the end, of course, Moses complied. He went along with it. So did Aaron. And so they get to be in the middle of this incredible situation with just amazing things happening. And they are successful and they do lead the people out. And so how rewarding that must have been. Now they paid a price. You can bet they paid a price, as we'll see. A harsh price. And yet, how would it feel to be Moses? It'd be pretty cool. Pretty freaking cool. And so it's a great privilege, really, for God to say, how about it? I got a role for you here. We're engaged in this big rescue plan. I want you to be my man. I want you to be my woman. And to help out on this. I'll be with you. Don't worry. I'll show you what to say. I'll empower you. But I need somebody that's going to say, yeah, I'll go. Finally, we saw that he makes big things out of little things. That God is the one who takes something as little as a stick and makes it big enough to whip the greatest empire on earth at that time is like nothing in front of this little stick. And that's a statement that God's making. That I don't need you to be someone awesome. I'm the awesome thing here. I'll take care of that part. I just need the willingness to step forward. And there you have a partial answer to who is Yahweh. All right.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.